I want to talk about how and why to build a Jewish library. Let me start first of all with a very strange, maybe sounds strange, but anyone know what the last mitzvah of the 613 commandments is in the Torah? 613, right? The first mitzvah is procreation, having children. What's the last mitzvah that appears in the Torah? Well, you are close. No, members of my family don't get it. Okay, go ahead. What is it? Correct. The last mitzvah of the Torah is the mitzvah to write a copy of the Torah scroll. You're obligated to write a copy of the Torah scroll. Now, we generally fulfill this. People either donate a Torah scroll, a letter to a Torah scroll. Sometimes you can go to a synagogue where a Torah scroll is being donated, a new one. What they do is they leave the last few sentences. The scribe just leaves the outlines of the letters, and people get an opportunity to fill in the letter. You pay some money, and it's like, because since the Torah is invalid without every single letter, therefore, if you fill in one letter, what have you done? You've made a Torah scroll, right? So it's a little bit of a, you know, a loophole, but it's, you see, to write a Torah scroll is very difficult, right? You have to be a registered, you don't have to be registered, but you have to have training as a scribe, and it takes a long time. Anyone know how much a Torah scroll costs approximately? Well, between 10 is very cheap, right? Generally, a cheap one would be about 20,000, and a reasonable, you know, middle of the ground expense would be about 30,000. Why does it cost so much? The materials are only a few thousand dollars, but it takes a scribe half a day for a year to write it. So you spend you're paying someone for 6 months' work, right? Or a year, half a day for a year of work. It's a lot. That's why it's going to be at least 20,000, you know. So now, for every person to do that is very difficult. I know of a retired math professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Professor Frohwein, who actually, when he retired, he learned how to be a scribe, and he wrote his own Torah scroll. And it was ready in time for the bar mitzvah of his 10th son. And I was at the bar mitzvah, and his 10th son read from the Torah scroll that the father had written. And there was a minyan of his own children. It was unbelievable. I've never been to a bar mitzvah like that. I mean, it beats the basketball-themed bar mitzvahs, and it beats chocolate place cards. Right, this is a bar mitzvah as it's meant to be, right? But of course, the problem is that the Torah says the following. You shall write yourself this song, the Torah, and teach it to the children of Israel, place it in their mouths. And the question is, do we actually study from a Torah scroll anymore? Do you know anyone who studies from a Torah scroll? No. We don't study from a Torah scroll. So many of our sages say that the obligation or the mitzvah is not fulfilled by writing a Torah scroll alone. You are obligated to now acquire the books from which you study. Because what is the purpose of this commandment? The Torah tells us, write the Torah in order to teach it to the children of Israel, place it in their mouths. Which means, and the Code of Jewish Law says, today we fulfill this mitzvah by the purchase or writing of Jewish books from which we learn. So actually, even if you cannot write a Torah scroll for yourself, even if you cannot afford to buy one, even if you are not a transcribe, but we fulfill this mitzvah by actually having Jewish books. That's point number one of why. Point number two, the atmosphere in a house is heavily affected by what the environment in the house is. If you walk into a house and the first thing you see is a 6-foot flat screen plasma television, with sense around speakers, DVD, video, remote controls, right, et cetera, right, Game Boys, wires all over the place, like my lecture rooms, right, that's one atmosphere. You walk into another house and what you see is basically modern art and all over the place. Okay, what if you walk into a house and it's surrounded by Jewish books? That's a very different atmosphere. And when our children see a house where really they can't move without seeing books, that's really very beautiful. That's the type of thing that we want to encourage. The treasure, the true treasure of the Jewish people of our house is really our knowledge and our Torah. And that is found in these books of the Torah, in the books of Judaism. And so from a purely psychological perspective, even if you're not going to open them, it's a nice thing to have Jewish books in the house. Right? Number three, Number three, you should get them color coordinated, granted, yes. Right, but number three is, well, obviously a pragmatic reason. Right, everyone has an obligation to study Torah. Everyone has an obligation to know what they should and should not do, to know the Jewish belief, to know, right? Better to know than not to know, as Spencer says. Right? It is always better to know. And knowledge and our obligation to know, of course, if we have books, is very, very helpful. You can always refer to them to know what to do to fulfill Jewish law. Jewish law is a little complex, right? Especially for a novice, a person who necessarily hasn't been raised with it from the time they were in kindergarten, right? It can be difficult. It can be confusing. There are literally thousands of books in English, in many, many languages, right, which translate all the major books of Judaism into languages we understand with footnotes, with diagrams, etc., etc. So Judaism is an accessible religion. It's very accessible because there are thousands of books out there. So, A, it's a mitzvah to write a Torah scroll which the commentaries understand as nowadays being fulfilled by the purchase of books from which we study. Number two, we want to create an atmosphere in our home in which the Torah is venerated, in which knowledge of Judaism is venerated, and that is what you see in the home. Number three, we are obligated to study, and we have to have books in order to study. Number four, we are obligated to know what to do, and very often to know what to do involves reading a book, figuring it out, getting the instructions, etc. There's also, I mean, for those who have more money, of course there is the wonderful connection you can have to the past by ancient books. That's of course something which is a little beyond, I'm sure beyond most of us, certainly beyond me. I have one book at home which I picked up at a secondhand bookstore in Israel for 20 shekel, which was like, at the time was about 15 bucks. That book dates back to 1720. Was printed in Manitoba, Italy in 1720. It is a beautiful little volume, called Tabuchei Zahav. Unfortunately, it's not worth a lot. A friend of mine who is the consultant on Jewish antiquities to Sotheby's, in Israel, told me that it's not worth much. And I said, great. He says, I'll give you 10 bucks for it. You know, probably it's worth thousands, you know. But anyway, no, he's a good friend of mine. I'm sure he's, right. It's not worth that much. But, you know, a Jewish book, I know someone in Toronto, Canada, who actually has the very first set of Talmud ever printed. It was printed by Daniel Bomberg in Venice in 1520. He's got a set. Cost him millions. He's a multi-millionaire. He has a library about actually a little bigger than this room, which has got shelves floor to ceiling all around. And you actually open up each shelf and behind it there's another layer of books of antiquity. But it's sealed and it's temperature controlled. It's quite an amazing thing. He has the first printed copy of Maimonides, Rome, 16th century, and the first printed Talmud, Venice. Imagine, you see, that's called a book from the 15th century, 14th century, 15th or 16th, is called an incunabulum, which is Latin for in the cradle. That's a book from the cradle of printing, because printing was only invented in the late 1400s, right? So it is very rare to have any book from then. And a Jewish book from them is even more rare. Why is a Jewish book rare? Because Jews got their books burnt and stolen very often. So to have a Jewish book from then is really something. I know someone who was a businessman who used to go to Eastern Europe and used to go to old synagogues and find ancient books. There's a fellow who lectures for Gateways, a Rabbi Feldhain in Yardley, Pennsylvania. He was a rabbi in Eastern Europe. He was the rabbi in Lithuania, just around Glasnost Perestroika. He has a wonderful collection of ancient books which were lying rotting in synagogues there. So that's a wonderful thing if you can do that. If people have in the family, it's always interesting to take it to an expert. If you have any of those things, bring them maybe to Next Gateways. I can tell you what it says on the front page. It's a very amazing story. I just going to tell you this story. There was a non-Jew from California who after college decided to go on a round-the-world trip. And he started by going around the USA. He's in New York, and he decided, he'd just seen a film about, that was involved with Williamsburg, which is a Hasidic area of New York, and he decided he'd like to see Williamsburg for himself. So he's waiting at a subway station, and he sees a Hasid, and he walks over to him, and he says, excuse me, can you tell me how to get to Williamsburg? The guy says, yeah, fine, I'm going there, get on the train with me, I'll tell you how to get there. So they schmooze, and the Hasid says, are you Jewish? The guy says, no. He says, where are you from? He says, California. He says, what's your name? And the guy tells him his name and says, well, that's a Jewish name. I said, no, it's a mistake, you know, I'm not Jewish. So my parents are from Russia, but I'm not Jewish. He said, well, you know, that name, he says, are your parents from? And he named a town in Russia. And the guy said, yeah, that's where my parents are from. So the chassid says, well, hey, my parents are from there as well. And you, my friend, are Jewish. And he goes, I just want to visit Williamsburg. I don't want to live there. You know what I mean? I'm not, right? He says, I am not Jewish. Never was Jewish. My parents are not Jewish. I'm not Jewish. I mean, we're not Christian. We're not doing nothing. Right? The chassid says, look, how did I know where your parents were from? The town wasn't that big. Every Jewish family knew each other, right? You've got that name. You are Jewish. The guy says, look, friend. He says, thank you for the advice and the trip. He says, I'm going to Williamsburg. I ain't Jewish. So the chassid says, he doesn't give up. He says, you're going to Israel? The guy says, yeah, probably eventually. I don't want to travel the whole world. Israel's a good place, yeah. So he says, I'll tell you what. If you're in Israel, he writes down on his business card, go to a place, and he writes down, Or Sameach. To Yeshiva, where I used to teach. And to Yeshiva in Jerusalem, for people who don't know much about, don't have much Jewish background. And the guy takes the business card, he says, thanks, puts it in the pocket of his parka, forgets about it. Anyway. It's about a year later, and he ends up in Jerusalem, and it's winter time. He's got his parka. Now, I do this, you know, I put on my jacket this last winter, and I take out of the pocket, there was actually a tube mat from London. The last time I wore it was at a winter trip to London the year before, right? So I'm there on Shabbos in Shul, and I look in my pocket, I take out the London subway mat, you know what I mean? So, ooh, okay. So he takes out this guy's card. He's at the Western Wall, and he takes out the guy's card. A fellow walks over to him. He says, hello, are you interested in going to a yeshiva? And the guy says, well, I'm not sure what a yeshiva is, but hold on. He says, you're familiar with this place? He says, Or Sameach. The guy says, hey, of course. Brings him to Or Sameach. The guy has lunch, comes to a couple of classes. He likes what he hears. And they start to talk to him, and he tells the rabbi there his story. Rabbi says, interesting, so that means you probably are Jewish. And I say, yeah. He decides to stay a little longer. He phones his parents. He says, hi, Dad. He says, where are you now, son? He says, I'm still in Israel. He says, whoa, you extended your stay? He says, yeah, I'm going to stay in Israel a little longer. He says, why? He says, I'm at a yeshiva. There is a thud and silence. His mother gets on the phone. She says, look, call back in an hour. Your father has just collapsed. Turns out he's fine. Right, he was just overcome, and he gets back on the phone, and he says, look, his father says, I don't know how you found out. I don't know who the hell told you. He says, I did you a favor. He says, I lived through the Second World War. I know what anti-Semitism is. I lived through communism. I know what that is. He says, your grandfather saw pogroms. I saw the Nazis. I saw the communists. He said, I did you the biggest favor in your life by not telling you you were Jewish. He said, no one has to know. Come back to California. Everything will go back like it was. No one knows. He says, you will not be subject to anti-Semitism, to hatred, to ridicule. Just forget it. Forget it. The kid says, I can't forget it. It rings true to me, and I've got to follow this. Father says, you know what? You're big and ugly enough to make your own decisions. Right? You know what? I tried to do you a favor. Do what you want. A few weeks later, he gets a package in the mail from his father. He opens it up, it's a Hebrew book, and there's a note from his father. This is the last remnants, the last artifact of Jewishness we have in our house. You can have it. You want to be Jewish, take it. So he opens it up, it's in Hebrew, he can't read it. And he takes it to one of the rabbis at Or Sameach. The rabbi opens it, starts reading the front page and starts crying. And the guy says, what does it say? And he says, well, first of all, he says, it's written by a man, and he gives him the name, and he says, wow. That's my family name. He said, well, it looks like it was your great-grandfather who wrote this book. And it says in the introduction, he says, I am not a great scholar. I don't want fame, and I don't plan to make money from writing this book of Torah thoughts. So why am I writing the book? He says, because I see the winds of change blowing through Russia. People are moving to communism and away from religion. He says, I don't think that my children will be religious. He says, I don't think my grandchildren will want to even be Jewish. And he says, my great-grandchildren may not even know that they're Jewish. He says, I'm writing this book so if any of my children find their way back home, they'll know who their great-grandfather was. An amazing, amazing thing. So that's the power of books sometimes. I'll tell you one more story about a book. Right, this story happened to a guy I know who was at the Mir Yeshiva in Jerusalem. M-I-R, not M-E-R-E, right? It was not the Mir Yeshiva as in, you know, it's Mir is a town in Lithuania. It actually means peace, I think, in Russian, right? As in Prospect Mira in Moscow, near the Vede Emche, is that correct? Yes. Okay. And I was there, stayed near there, the Hotel Cosmos. Anyway, so the Mir Yeshiva, a very large yeshiva, and he's traveling home for vacation to New York. And everyone learns with a study partner at yeshivas. He didn't have one for the next semester. But he's on the plane, and he walks by and he sees, he figured maybe I'll find someone on the plane. There's a whole bunch of yeshiva guys going back to the States. He sees a guy asleep, and open is a book that's open on the table next to the guy. He looks at the book, you know, guys are at yeshiva, right? If you see an open Hebrew book, what is that? Right? Just a normal thing. Right? He's never seen the title. He says, the title sounds right. He flicks to the front of the book, the guy's still asleep. He sees that there's two authors, and one of them is his own grandfather. He waits till the guy wakes up, and he says, hey, I just see the book, my name is so-and-so, and he says, I see this book is written by my grandfather, one of the authors. The guy says, that's interesting, because the other author is my grandfather. He says, they used to study together in Europe. And the guy says, well, it's interesting, are you going back to Israel? He says, yeah, where are you going to learn? He says, at the mirror. He says, do you have a chavrusa? Do you have a study partner? The guy says, no. He says, they study together. A good friend of mine, Akiva Tatz, Dr. Akiva Tatz, you may have heard of him, he's written a number of books, we are close friends, and we were yeshiva together. He heard this story from the guy, he went back to our Rebbe, Rav Moshe Shapiro, and he says, Rabbi Shapiro, I've got to tell you this amazing story. He tells him the story. Rav Moshe Shapiro says, "Nu, atamik kaven l'chadesh li shakadosh baruch hu manhigat ha'olam." So Rav Moshe Shapiro says, he says, and you are excited to tell me that you found that God runs the world? This is like a novel thing to you. You know, like, Rav Moshe Shapiro is so totally unimpressed. He's like, that Rabbi Tatz said, I went, he says, what do you mean? Of course God runs the world. What do you expect? You know, that's the way it goes. He's very good. My teacher is very good at that. He's like, it deflates you quickly. Right? I remember I was in the army. I used to do a month of reserve duty. So once I was doing reserve duty in Ramallah. So Ramallah is not far from Jerusalem. It's about, you can get it 20 minutes, actually 15, 20 minutes from the place I used to teach. And so my teacher used to give a class there 2 till 3 every Monday. So in the army I couldn't go to it, which was a great, great pain to me. And, but one day, this Monday, I was able to get the afternoon off from the army base. Like I begged the officer, like, please, please. So fine. He let me go. I get a hitch to Jerusalem and I'm in uniform. I've got my Galil rifle and it's 2 o'clock. Rav Moshe Shapiro is about to start his class, right? And I walk in, totally so proud of myself, like I made it for the class. I walk in, he looks at me, and he says, oh, our hero. And I just went like, ego, ego alert. Anyway, so we digressed a little bit, but the beauty of books, and there's nothing like an old book that you've used and that's well-worn, and I think there's a big difference when you have your own book, and you borrow one from a library. When you study Torah, it's wonderful to have your own book. First of all, when you see how worn it gets, you can log your progress a bit. You know what I mean? There's something we can use every little help we can get in encouraging us to study, right? And if by seeing that the book is getting worn and well thumbed, that encourages me, which it does. I like that, right? Then it's, as long as the binding doesn't break, I like it otherwise, right? Then that's good. So that's number one. And number two, you can write notes. Your own book, you can write notes. You're not allowed to do this with library books, by the way. Point out, right? Or in your local synagogue, you should not do that, right? But in your own books, you can write notes. You can write translations. It's a wonderful thing. You can look at it years later. I had a beautiful experience. I think it was one of my kids, was it you? Who was using a piece of Talmud that I used in Yeshiva. And he's studying the same tractate. And he told me that something they were studying was in one of the notes that I had written when I was 18 studying that same tractate. Right? That's a beautiful thing. That's nice. Right, so that's another reason to have your own library. So those are some reasons to have your library. Of course, you need money for this. I'm sorry to inform you. Right, but okay, now what I want to do is go through just a couple, I have given you a actual sheet with my recommendations. It's not an exhaustive sheet. I'll tell you why. If I would write this sheet today and print it and give it out to you, by next week, every single category would have another book, which I would have to recommend. So this is done a couple of years ago. I've added books, but it's not exhaustive. There may be books there, but this is just like, you know, my selections, which I think are very useful. If you look, the mother of all books, right, is the Chumash, the five books of Moses. The best edition of that, there are two best, really a few. The best, if you like translations which are in readable modern English, with great footnotes in terms of, if anyone is into things like, if it says Atzmona, you want to know where Atzmona is in the Bible? You want to see a map? Or if it says Fenugreek, you want to know what the heck is Fenugreek? Right? It's Chilba, by the way, for those who want to know. Right? If you want to know what it is, look. So Aria Kaplan has a modern English translation of the Bible, which is just so beautifully readable. There's nothing like it. And it's got great little footnotes of that sort, geographical. It tells you what an ibex is, and what a hare and stuff like a coney, all the biblical animals, all that type of stuff. Those who are into that, there are a lot of people who like that. I love that type of stuff, and the Living Bible's for you. However, if you want to get really in depth, you don't really care much about the beauty of the translation. You want to get really in depth. There's the most beautiful commentary in depth with Samson Raphael Hirsch. It's found in six volumes by Sonsino Press, and Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch was a great scholar in the 19th century Germany, who was able to explain deep, deep Torah concepts for secular Jews in Germany in the 19th century, and he does it just as good, just as well, for us in the 21st century. There is an abbreviated version called Trumat Tzvi. Another in-depth one is Nachmanides' translation, which is commentary, translated by Charles B. Chevelle, that's in English, very Kabbalistic. There's a lot of Kabbalah in there. Then you've got the Stone Chumash, the classic art scroll has really just taken over the Jewish world. The standard prayer book used just everywhere is art scroll. It's a wonderful prayer book. It's got a great translation. It tells you instructions, when to stand, when to sit, the whole works, right? Great index and great notes. They've done the same with the Chumash. It's called the Stone Chumash, financed by the Stone family. And this Chumash has got a great translation. It's a little more classic. There are a lot of people who don't like reading modern English translations of the Bible. It doesn't give you the biblical feel. You know what I mean? Right, I personally, right, I like the notes in the Living Torah, but I prefer a more classic translation. I like to feel that I'm reading the Bible, not a novel, you know? So the article is more classic, but the notes are a abbreviated, like, an anthology of all the great commentaries and what they say. It's a wonderful, and it's got a great index, by the way, at the back, and it's got diagrams and genealogical charts. It's really phenomenal. There's a couple of specialized ones here. Beginning and Upheaval is actually a translation, an in-depth translation, in-depth commentary called the Malbim. Very unusual to get it in English on parts of Genesis, those who are interested specifically in the Genesis parts of the Torah. Nach, which are the prophets and writings, the Jerusalem Bible, which is Koren publishing. By the way, Jerusalem Bible is a famous Christian translation of the Bible. Don't be confused. There's two Jerusalem Bibles. I'm talking about the Jerusalem Bible by Koren publishing. There's another Jerusalem Bible, which is published by some Christian group, right? And that is not the one I'm recommending, right? This is the Jewish translation, Koren. This is the standard edition, by the way, given out in the army at the end of basic training. They give you an edition of the Tanakh. It's the Koren edition, Hebrew only. The Psalms translation, again, commentary by Samson Raphael Hirsch. And you can get different books on different parts of the Torah. Like if you're interested in Purim, there's a great, commentary on the Scroll of Esther. If you're interested in Samson, each one, and you can get pretty much a translation and commentary in every one of the books of the Bible. Shabbat and festivals. I tell you, if you want one book which has got it all, the whole Jewish year, the Book of Our Heritage, Eliyahu Kitov. It's three volumes in English. It goes through every month of the Jewish year and tells you today is so-and-so. On this day, right, this and this happened. These are the customs that commemorate it. These are the laws. These are the philosophy. The stories associated with it, everything you always wanted to know. You, if you pick up Book of Our Heritage, you will be knowledgeable about the Jewish calendar instantly. I mean, you have to read it. You have to remember it. But what? Maybe. Right. So it's called Eliyahu Kitzov, Book of Our... It comes in a pocket edition, which... What's your name? Is it? Beth has it at the back there. That's one of the three volumes. It's a great pocket edition. It is a wonderful... I cannot recommend it highly enough. Because I'll tell you what, it's just so, sometimes people get confused with the Jewish year. So they get confused. Is it the 3 weeks or the counting of the Omer? What the heck are we counting in the Omer? Right, and that type of stuff. Rosh Hashanah comes before Yom Kippur, but Rosh Hashanah, which is the new year, comes in the seventh month. This can be confusing, understandably. Right, and there are 2 days of the new year. So which is the day of the last year, which is the first? All this type of stuff, everything explained, Eliyahu Kitov. Then, if you want something, an in-depth work on Sabbath, it's called The Sabbath by I. Grunfeld. He was a judge in the rabbinical court in London and also an international lawyer and is the most comprehensive, in English at least, but it's not just the laws of Shabbos, it gives you the philosophy of Shabbos as well. It's just a beautiful volume. Okay. By the way, there's the very famous Mirot of Sabbath songs. You want to know what people are singing, there's two versions. The NCSY song, well, that's the one we use here, is great because it has English, Hebrew, and also transliteration. Of course, it's transliterated into American Hebrew, right? So that's unfortunate. But nevertheless, I'm sure most of you are Americans, so therefore it's not a problem for you. But it also is helpful. It's got all the famous songs. People break out into a song. You can find it in the NCSY book. Very handy to have a bunch of them around. And, of course, these Mirot for Shabbat as well. Then you've got different ones. Well, you see here, etc. Haggadah. There's hundreds of Haggadahs. Hundreds of them. Right. The simplest is, again, the Art Scroll family Haggadah. I do write for Art Scroll, but they're not paying me to do this advertisement. I'm sorry. Right, really. Yeah.
All of these books pretty much, what level? Are they all different levels of knowledge and learning? Or can you keep them on
the page? Most of them, the ones that I've picked out verbally, everyone can access them. Not without effort, necessarily. They're not novels, right? So, but nevertheless, they're certainly accessible. Teshuvah, repentance. This is anatomy research is great. It's by this friend of mine, Akiva Tatz, who is a physician in South Africa, and it's his journey to Judaism. He's now a world famous rabbi and lecturer, and a top scholar in Jerusalem. And it's just a very interesting personal account of his return to Judaism, which I think is wonderful. A little more philosophy about the philosophy of repentance is Pathways by Shlomo Wolbe. And for those who are really, if you want to get into intellectual stuff, this is very in-depth, very intellectual, very worthwhile. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, Soloveitchik on Repentance. Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik was one of the great intellectuals and philosophers of the Jewish world last century, founder of Yeshiva University in New York. And, of course, it's not worth reading it in Hebrew, because he uses words like neo-Kantian ontology and stuff like that, which translates to Hebrew. You know, you won't know what the heck he's talking about. So the English itself will need a dictionary, but it's very, very worthwhile. After the Return is unfortunately out of print. But if you phone Feldheim and bug them, who are my publishers, they may put it out on market again. It's a book that I wrote together with my study partner on how to come back to Judaism and not alienate everyone, and not drive yourself insane, how to be religious without having religiosis. Okay, one is a disease, one is good, right? It's called After the Return. Bug Feldheim, maybe they'll reprint it. Mitzvot. The first one I've got here, the second one, sorry, is the Mitzvot, which is by Abraham Chill. I'll tell you what's good about this. It lists all 613 commandments, gives you the verses in the Bible from which they are derived, and it gives you a brief anthology of the reasons given for each one of the commandments. What could be wrong? Huh? Right, you've got all 613, so it's a great thing to study. More in depth is something like Chorev by Samson Raphael Hirsch. The good thing about Chorev, which is unique, I've got it written here, H-O-R-E-B, Chorev, right, but it's actually pronounced Chorev, is that what he does is he shows the unity of halacha and philosophy, Jewish law and philosophy. He shows you how the details of the law flow from the philosophy and how the philosophy flows from the law. So it's a complete unified view of the Torah. The problem with it is it's an English translation of his original German. Now German, you know what they say about German is that it starts that a German dives into the Atlantic with a noun on one side, and the verb doesn't turn up until he emerges on the other side of the Atlantic after swimming all that length. Right? So German sentences can be long and unwieldy. And translating to English, it's not easy reading, but it's really worthwhile, very comprehensive, wonderful book. Specific commandments, there are things like the Royal Table, or Grünfeld, on Kashrut, which is a fantastic, maybe I didn't put it here. Yeah, it's called, the Jewish Dietary Laws by I. Grünfeld, which is two volumes in English, comprehensive laws of the Jewish, of dietary laws, and also their philosophy and rationale as well. And as you see here, each book, by the way, one of the authors here is Arya Kaplan, crops up a lot. He's got the best, most compact books about Judaism, deceptively simple. He was a very, very great scholar, a rabbinic scholar and also a physicist, and wrote prolifically. And pretty much any book by Arya Kaplan you see, I highly recommend for anyone on any level, advanced, intermediate, beginners. Philosophy. Living Up to the Truth is not available in bookstores. You can download it from the internet, though. If anyone has heard Rabbi Rieti's Encounter at Sinai, this is a very, very rigorously presented intellectual presentation of that same argument, which dates back to the 12th century. It's called Living Up to the Truth. You can download it free from the internet at www.ohr.org.il. ohr.org.il. It's the Or Sameach website. Look around on the website, you'll find it's called Living Up to the Truth, where you can also download from there is criticism of his verification of the Torah by a secular philosopher and Rabbi Gottlieb's response to it. So it's really wonderful. Really wonderful. Rabbi Gottlieb, just to give you background, is a close friend of mine. He is, actually many of these authors are, I have good friends. So anyway, but he, was a professor of analytical philosophy at Johns Hopkins University, has published a book with Oxford University on mathematical philosophy, and is a Bostoner Chosid. And he's a lecturer in Jewish philosophy in Jerusalem, and his book is just brilliant. It's called Living Up to the Truth. The Kuzari is a classic. It is a debate between a pagan king, a Christian, a Muslim, a philosopher, and eventually a rabbi. Most of the book is the rabbi's explanation of Judaism to this pagan king. It's a book that cannot read. You have to study, preferably with a partner. Yeah, every book I have here is in English. You can get it also in French and Russian and German. The informed soul, also by Rabbi Gottlieb, and the Jewish self, this is only if you, for real intellectuals here, the Jewish self, very, very in-depth understanding of Judaism, but very difficult reading. I mean, not that it's not written well, it's written beautifully. Actually, this guy was at my house for Shabbos, Jeremy Kagan's good friend of mine as well. He studied philosophy at Yale. He's from Hawaii originally. And, he studied, in Jerusalem many years under my teacher of Moshe Shapiro. And this is a book that he wrote, which contains a lot of the philosophy of the Maharal of Prague and Moshe Shapiro of Jerusalem, usually inaccessible to English speakers, but he has written it in a very beautiful way that makes it accessible to anyone. Next page, Kabbalah. I think the probably, in terms of classic texts, the Way of God is the classic text of Kabbalah, as is the Knowing Heart by an Italian Jewish Kabbalist, Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. And the next best is Living Inspired and World Master by Akiva Tatz. On prayer, the best prayer book is the Complete Art Scroll Siddur. You can get it in the paperback, paperback soft cover pocket size or the large one. There's many different editions. There's a large print one. There's an interlinear one. There's one with transliteration. But really, they're very good, and they're pretty much the standardized ones in most Orthodox synagogues today. You'll find that everyone uses that. If you want to study prayer, get yourself the Hirsch Siddur or the World of Prayer by Munk. They're both in-depth study of what the prayers mean, and a book recently published, Prayerfully Yours by Abraham Twersky.
It's expensive. It's about $37. But it's a big book with insights about prayer from Abraham Twersky. Yeah. Talmud. Well, Talmud in English is the Art Scroll Schottenstein edition, which they are going through the entire Talmud. It's the best translation and annotated edition. If you want to know about the philosophy of the oral law, Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cardozo, the book is called The Infinite Chain, Torah, Masorah, and Man. And there are some dictionaries here also, etc. Men and women. Out of all these books, I think the last one is probably one of the best, To Be a Jewish Woman by Lisa Aiken, psychologist living in New York. It's called To Be a Jewish Woman. In terms of intimacy, and I think the two of the best ones here are The Magic Touch and Doesn't Anyone Blush Anymore. Both excellent books. For a more technical analysis of how Jewish law and women and the interplay there, look at Meiselman, the first one there, Jewish Women in Jewish Law, Jewish Woman in Jewish Law. And of course, in terms of marriage, the Jewish way in love and marriage is a classic, classic one of these ideas. Jewish law, it depends what you want to look at. So different parts of this talk about different laws. You can see there, they're self-explanatory. I'm not going to recommend any specific one because they're all about different subjects. Ethics and self-improvement. The one that I like the best out of this list is Strive for Truth by Eliyahu Dessler. Rabbi Dessler was a great sage from Europe, later on in England, later on in Israel. I like recommending him. He was actually the teacher of my teacher. And so much of the philosophy that I teach and Torah I teach comes from Rabbi Dessler and from my reading of Rabbi Dessler. I feel a tremendous affinity to this. I think it speaks to people who are sincere in the modern world, looking for truth very, very well. There's a few volumes. When I wrote this, there's only one volume. I think there's now three volumes of it out in English. Contemporary issues. If you're interested in Jewish law, the classic is J. David Bleich, who's a professor of law at Yeshiva University, and it's called Contemporary Halachic Problems. I think there's actually four or five volumes now. When I wrote this, there were only three. Everything from organ transplants to Ethiopian Jews being Jewish and the whole combat ethics, every contemporary issue you can imagine, probably some you cannot imagine, right, explained here. Business ethics in the marketplace, a whole series by Meir Tamari. Meir Tamari used to be the chief economist of the Bank of Israel. He's an Orthodox Jew, he's got a doctorate in economics, and he's one of the greatest authorities in Jewish business ethics, and it's fascinating. There's a whole series by him. I only have the one in the marketplace. He's got others. One of them is called The Challenge of Wealth. He's got a bunch of them. The name is Meir Tamari. That's the last on that page in Contemporary Issues. Oh, by the way, Science and Torah, there's two books that came out after this, which I don't have here, which I recommend highly. One of them is called The Science of Torah by Nosson Slifkin, S-L-I-F-K-I-N. That is the best, I think. And another one is by Andy Goldfinger, who lectures for us, and it's called Thinking About Creation. He's also a Hasidic Jew, who is the assistant director of the NASA satellite design labs in Johns Hopkins. He lectures for us sometimes, and that's a great book called Thinking About Creation. The Land of Israel. If you're going to Israel and you want a travel guide, a great book is Jewish Israel. And if you want to know, there's another one which came out recently. It's called Myths, Facts and Myths. Right? Great book. Get it from Amazon. Myths and Facts, or Facts and Myths about Israel. Great book about the current situation. And Jerusalem, Eye of the Universe by Arya Kaplan. Much of what I spoke about in my previous class about Jerusalem you can find in that book. Kashrut and kosher cooking. My wife does the cooking and I eat it. So I recommend anything she uses. But specifically, the spice and spirit of kosher Jewish cooking is great. I'll tell you why it's good. A, the recipes usually work, which you cannot say about the same for every cookbook. And B, it gives you suggested menus. See, we have family traditions. What did my wife's mother make for this yontif? What does my mother make for this yontif? But what if you don't have that, right? So this has got menus, suggested menus for Yontif, traditional food, brief explanations, fantastic book. And the same is true of the Passover feast by American Mizrahi women. It's also, all the recipes tend to work, and they also give great explanations of Passover stuff there. History. Well, the Beryl Wine, W-E-I-N, at that time he only had one volume out. Now he's, I think, got four. And those, this is the best series of Jewish history. Unfortunately, they're large coffee table type books. They're a lot of money. Anti-Semitism and the Holocaust. The best one about the Holocaust is the second last one with God in Hell by Eliezer Berkowitz. And the last one there is the best book on anti-Semitism ever read, called Why the Jews by Telushkin and Prager. Missionaries and the Cults. The first one is the best. The Jew and the Christian Missionary by Siegel. Dictionary is the first one, number 19. Alkali Dictionary is a three-volume, fantastic. It's got biblical usage, modern Hebrew usage. It gives you phrases. It gives you quotations from Jewish sources. The best Hebrew-English, English-Hebrew dictionary. And finally, biographies, of which there is no end to biographies, but I would recommend highly Generation to Generation and Reb Moshe by Art Scholars. Two recently came out. One is the biography of Rabbi Deslot by Jonathan Rosenblum, who's a writer in the Jerusalem Post, a close friend of mine, lives near us in Jerusalem, and he wrote biographies of Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler and also of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. They're probably the two best biographies out there, and I've got to end now because the next speaker is my wife, and I don't want to hold her up. So thank you very much.